Good morning, everybody. I call the Commerce Finance Policy Committee meeting to order for February 18th. A quorum is present. We do have minutes, so Chair O'Driscoll may have a motion to approve the minutes from April 3rd, 2025.
Madam Chair, I will move the minutes of the meeting of April
3rd.
Let's double check this. There we go. April 3rd. My gosh, that seems like a long time ago. But it's only like the first year anniversary is only like less than 6 weeks away from this, so that's good. I move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chair O'Driscoll moves the approval of the minutes from April 3rd. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right. So, we have a committee protocol that I'm going to read through once for the beginning of this, and then just kind of make everybody has a set for the rules. So welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. We appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process. To ensure that everyone can view, hear, and understand today's proceedings, we ask you for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing. For safety and security and comfort of all attendees, please note the following guidelines. I, as the committee chair, maintain control of these proceedings and establish the following expectations. No signs or place cards permitted in the hearing room. No verbal outbursts, shouting, disruptive behavior. Applause or audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing and sitting in the walkways, aisles, or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you need any requirements, please make sure to talk to the sergeant staff. Troopers and house security personnel are present to ensure everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given specific time limits, which must be strictly observed. If you received an entrance ticket, please retain it, as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the hearing room. And we will have our gold ties here to deal with any disruptive behavior if needed so. So that's out of the way. So I just wanted to also say a few words. We have some members, staff introductions. And so if we have some new members this year on the committee, including me. So if we would maybe just want to go around the room and introduce ourselves. Maybe just say what district we represent, and I'm Erin Cagle. I represent District 39A, which is Fridley, Hilltop, Columbia Heights, and Spring Lake Park. Take University Avenue North, and you'll get there. So maybe we can start down here with Rep. Perryman.
I'm Representative Bernie Perryman. I represent 14A, which is the St. Cloud, St. Augusta, Wake Park, St. Joe area.
Thank you.
And this is welcome to our new chair.
I'm Max Reimer. I represent 28B, which is Chisago County. And what
Thank
else
you.
Can I say?
I'm
glad to be here.
A lot of lakes there.
Hi, everybody. My name is Keith Allen. I'm the representative from 19A. It encompasses the communities of Kenyon, Wanamingo, Faribault, and Janesville, Minnesota. So, thanks.
Hello, everybody. I'm Scott Van Binsbergen. I'm from Central Minnesota. I represent 16A, and the communities, a couple of those communities that you might recognize are Montevideo, Litchfield, Olivia.
Greg Davids, 26B, border Iowa and Wisconsin, Fillmore, Houston, and part of Maurer County.
Representative Jeff Dotseth, 11A, which is actually all of Carlton County, Northern Pine, Southern St. Louis, and I encourage each and every one of you to come up and do some commerce up in our district.
Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal Staff.
And I'm Laurie Pompu, House Research.
Ben Fries, GOPCA.
Justin McArdle, new GOP researcher for the Commerce Committee.
Co-chair Jim O'Driscoll from 13B, which are the cities of Sartell, Sauk Rapids, St. Stephen, Holding Fort, Holding Township, among others. And I would just like to welcome the new co-chair to the meeting, as well as Representative Hansen, Representative Buck. Before we get to you, thanks for joining us. Appreciate having you here. I think you'll find this a very accommodating and a productive committee. Thank you.
Alex Wheeler, Committee Legislative Assistant for the DFL Caucus.
Good afternoon. Morning, everybody. Sam O'Neill, the DFL Committee Administrator.
Steve Elkins, 50B, western half of Bloomington.
Lee Finke, she, her pronouns only. I represent District 66A, St. Paul, Falcon Heights, Roseville, and Lauderdale.
Representative Andy Smith, 25B, Rochester, downtown surrounding areas.
I represent Alex Falconer, 49A, which is Eden Prairie and Minnetonka.
John Hewitt, I represent 56B, which is Apple Valley, Rosemount, and Eagan.
Ethan Shaw, Woodbury, 47B.
Hello, my relatives. Greet you with a good heart and handshake. My name is Shelley Buck. I am representative for 47A, which is South Maplewood and Woodbury.
Eric Anderson, DFL Research.
I'm Representative Jess Hansen. I represent 55A, which is the entire city of Savage in the northwest part of Burnsville.
Carly Katiza Watun, I represent 49B, which is the rest of Eden Prairie, and this is my fourth term on the Commerce Committee.
Thank you. And just kind of just wanted to set out kind of our goals and for the committee. And so although I am new to this committee, I have served for four of the past 5 years on this committee, so I'm excited to be back, although I'm not a morning person. So once the caffeine wears off, I might get a little grumpy. But over the past few weeks, I've really gotten to know Chair O'Driscoll better, and I'm very much looking forward to working with you this session. And, you know, being that it's both of our last sessions, we kind of have talked that we wanted to decide that we want to get stuff done in this committee. Consumer protections, fairness, and transparency seem to be shared goals of ours this session. And we also, so we expect that we'll be able to find solutions to problems facing Minnesota by listening to one another and not assuming each other's motives, asking questions out of a place of understanding, and considering each other's questions thoughtfully without ego. Something that I've been kind of living by for the past year is mean what you say what you mean, but don't say it mean. And then with that being said, I also want to say that we do have some caucus goals as well that we're going to be working on. And so we understand that, you know, Minnesotans are hardworking, and although the, you know, stock market appears to be great, we know that, you know, we're not feeling that in our households. Health insurance, housing, homeowners, auto insurance, grocery bills, they're all places where a lot of Minnesotans are struggling, and we know that the system is kind of rigged against us, that low and middle middle-income Americans are kind of, the system is set up to extract wealth from us, so the billionaire class can, you know, have $55 million weddings. And so I just wanted to come to this committee with a lesson my grandma taught me when I was probably preteen. I'll never forget it, when I was sitting in her living room in Silver Bay, and they had cable, which was a luxury. My grandparents had cable, so that was really cool. And so I was watching MTV Cribs in her living room, and I was explaining to the show to her, and this woman raised six kids in a three-bedroom, one-bathroom house. And she, at the end of the episode, you know, she wasn't very outspoken or opinionated. She's a little Irish Catholic lady. And she looked at me in a really stoic but soft tone and said two words, "That's sinful." And so in that moment, I kind of realized that there's a real divide between the have and the have-nots. And we're seeing that play out in our economy. Since 1989, Americans, the share of Americans' wealth held by the nation's wealthiest has risen. Federal Reserve data shows that the richest 10% of American households now own over two-thirds of the nation's wealth, and 1% holds 31% of the total wealth, and that's just slightly less than the entire bottom 90% of U.S. households. And so make no mistake, this is a policy choice. People who can afford to buy the laws, buy them so that they can legally extract wealth from us. And so we have an opportunity to work together across party lines and ensuring that we can unrig a system and put power back into people's hands. And so, again, these are policy choices, and I don't think I have any billionaires in my district, but we want to make sure that the government is here to provide for the public good. You know, government services shouldn't be outsourced to entities that have any other motivations besides serving Minnesotans. And so I look forward to working with each and every one of you on this committee. Members, lobbyists, constituents, and everyday Minnesotans. And so with that, I just want to say LFG, and I will turn it over to Chair O'Driscoll to give his opening remarks as well for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we did last year, we had some general goals. And number one was we felt that bills that had DFL and GOP authors that were close to the one and two spots, that those were good bills that we would work with. And we also wanted to reach out and work with our Senate counterparts in the commerce arena to find good solutions to tough problems. And I thought we were pretty successful in doing that last year as a team. And we took our time to do our working committee. And sometimes that meant that we had presentations like we're going to have today so that the committee can learn more about what's going on so they can make very thoughtful and reflectful decisions and ask informed questions on the topics that are, as Chair Cagle said, important to the people of the state of Minnesota. One of the things that I think when Chair Cagle and I sat down, we said, we're going to be able to move forward. And she said, how did you... And Chair her work on things. I said, we had a very open relationship. We said what we meant, as she said, and we said what we meant, right? It's, we know that there are going to be goals that maybe the DFL wants to go and really the top priority, but there are things that I can't bring votes for from our caucus and vice versa. Mm-hmm. We will not take those things personally. That's to the nature of the environment that we're in. But there is a wide, wide universe of things out there that need the help of the people that sent the people here. And I think we can get to those end games as a team if we collectively work together, which would be refreshing. And I want to thank this team and welcome the new members to this team from last year. What we did was nothing short, in my opinion, of amazing. We found common ground on some difficult topics, and we helped Minnesotans. And we can continue to build on that this year. And as we've been having staff meetings, if you will, with the chairs and with senior staff and on this, I don't think ever once we said, Republicans this, Democrats that. We said, what is good for Minnesota? What are we going to lead with? How are we going to work on those things? And there are going to be bills that folks are going to be bringing forward, and we need to work on those. And one of the things that Chair Cagle and I talked about that we thought would be helpful in this 90-day session, which we are now down to about 86 days or 87 days of session, is that we would have some informational meetings on some topics that we think that are important to people and have been important in this legislature. Get them on the table, get the parties together, get them to hear where the legislature is coming from, and then get to work to see if they can find solutions. Then later on in the session, when we come back and we say, okay, it's time to update, how'd you do on your homework assignment? And if they're at a spot where we can work with that bill, we're going to bring it forward, and we're going to work on it as a committee. If there's an impasse or we're not there, we're unfortunately going to have to take a pass on it. But we have set some priorities that we think are the common priorities of the people in this committee and the business that comes before this committee. So we are going to be having a number of those kinds of things. And, again, I want this committee to ask good questions. We're not shy. I know that from past experience about asking those, as long as they're fair questions and not gotcha questions for people. And so, again, Chair Cagle, thank you for the opportunity to kind of, fill in and shade in some of the color on the schematic here of how we're working together and what we've talked about. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And so with that, we will start out with our first presentation. We have the Minnesota Department of Commerce and MNsure presentation on the state of the private insurance market. And with us, we have Erica Anderson, Helvec Anderson, and Julia Dreyer. Okay, good. I'm horrible. I'm horrible at it. And I always joke I should have just stuck with Anderson. Nobody would have mispronounced then. So welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair Cagle. Good morning. Really appreciate you having me here today. Again, my name is Julia Dreyer. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Insurance at the Department of Commerce. And I'm joined here by my colleague, Sam Smith, who's the Director of Government Affairs at Commerce, and then Erica Helvec Anderson, who's the Senior Director of Public Affairs at MNsure. So I will be touching on what Commerce is currently observing in the individual insurance market, as well as the commercial insurance market more generally. And then Erica will be sharing more information on MNsure's most recent. Most Minnesotans continue to get their insurance through their employer or through some form of a government program such as Medicare or Medicaid. which we refer to as medical assistance here in Minnesota. What we regulate here in at Commerce is the individual and the small group market, so those tiny little green slivers down at the bottom of the graph. It's a tiny but overall important, but it's a tiny part of the pie, but an important component of how many Minnesotans access their insurance. The state also has some jurisdiction over medical assistance and Minnesota Care, and the federal government oversees most large group plans as well as Medicare. Well, each of these component parts of the health insurance ecosystem have their own rules governing how they function. They are also increasingly interdependent on one another. Changes in one space frequently have an impact on another part of the market. As we all know, health insurance is expensive, and what we're seeing in terms of cost increases in the health insurance market is largely driven by what it costs to provide that care. So some trends that we're seeing, there are significant changes in medical technology and treatments, so that's things like specialty prescription drugs for rare and genetic diseases. They can also be very expensive. Weight loss drugs like GLP-1s are popular and pricey. And then cancer treatments are increasingly personalized, and again, that life-saving, but they can be expensive treatments. Our population in general, particularly here in Minnesota, which trends a little bit older, is getting sicker, and they're using more healthcare services. That's largely driven by aging. And then the other thing we're seeing is just in terms of contracting with providers, and that is getting more expensive. So you're seeing things like more consolidation, increased staffing costs, and then just inflation. We also continue to see some unique trends impacting different market segments. So in the Medicare market, we're seeing the impacts of the aging population through higher demand and utilization of healthcare, and that can also lead to costlier provider contracts. The Medicaid market is continuing to fluctuate following the expiration of the public health emergency and with new enrollment restrictions. Enrollment in the small group market continues to decline. We're seeing healthier groups choosing to self-fund or take on some more of that risk and leaving the remaining pool sicker and more expensive. Mm-hmm. And then the elimination of the enhanced premium tax credits in the individual market increases the risk of healthier people leaving that portion of the market and driving up costs. None of these issues on their own is particularly unusual, but what we are seeing is that combination of those changes being particularly challenging. We are also seeing changes with in policy decisions that the federal government is making, both through legislative decisions, such as HR1, as well as executive agency actions and rulemaking. Some of the changes in particular that we're following looking at the individual market, Congress did not pass funding to allow for the continuation of what we refer to as the enhanced premium. So the Affordable Care Act included tax credits that capped what people making under 400% of the federal poverty limit, so that's around $60,000 a year for an individual. So what they paid in premiums, they capped that at roughly 8.5% of their income.
Can I just ask you to move the mic closer?
Oh, sure.
Thank you.
No problem. Is that better?
Yes.
I feel like I'm really close to the mic. Okay. And then during the public health emergency, Congress extended these tax credits to ensure that no one was paying more than 8.5% of their income on premiums. So the expectation with that expiration of those enhanced tax credits, the expectation is that those who are healthier may choose to forego health insurance, leading to a sicker and more expensive pool of people. There have also been a variety of changes that make it harder for people to enroll in coverage. So human nature being what it is, those who need coverage the most also tend to be the most motivated to go through the enrollment process. So federal changes impact how MNsure can auto-enroll people in coverage. It restricts the state's ability to set annual and special open enrollment periods, and it adds some red tape to certain eligibility requirements. The federal changes also impact eligibility for tax credits, making coverage more expensive for certain groups of Minnesotans. There are also a variety of changes that allow for, that impact what people can purchase. So for example, all bronze plans are now considered to be high deductible health plans, and those are eligible to be paired with health savings accounts. Looking just at bringing this back into what Commerce does, so every year we review health insurance rates for carriers in the individual that sell in the individual and small group markets. So we don't set the rates. What we're doing is we are making sure that the rates are justified, so meaning that the carriers are charging enough and not charging too little to be able to pay premiums. We do see rates rising every year, typically due to increased costs and usage of medical care. We also review filings every year for compliance with state and federal law, including coverage of things like pre-existing conditions and no-cost preventative care, making sure that that carriers have adequate provider networks and making sure that individuals can enroll and have their claims paid appropriately. Again, these are just base rates, that's not what people pay. Actual premiums can vary from person to person and depends on where people live, their age, and their eligibility for tax credits. The individual market, so the final rate increases that we saw for 2026, so those are for plans that were sold starting in started in January. So the average increase this year was a little over 21.1%. The medical trend that we are seeing is around a little over 9%, so it's 9.4% for the individual market. One thing to note is that we are seeing an increase in medical loss ratio, so that is what carriers are paying for medical claims. So there's a requirement that they have to pay at least 80 or 85% of their premium dollars on medical claims, and the rest is going towards helping to run the insurance company, improve technology, that sort of thing. Medical loss ratio requirements for both the individual and small group market were above 90%. Part of what we're seeing in both the individual and small group market with these rate increases is that plans are thinking they didn't charge enough, both for 2024 and in 2025, to help cover their costs. We also saw increases in the small group market, though not as high as in the individual market. So the average increase for 2026 was 14.2%. Unlike the individual market, where we have some costs defrayed by the state for new benefit requirements, we are seeing a little bit more of an impact of any new benefit mandates in this particular market. We're also continuing to watch this market very closely because we're concerned that the market is shrinking, and that also drives up rates. Despite the fact that benefit mandates do impact rate increases, what is really driving the increases that we're seeing is costs. So it's that some of the items I mentioned earlier in terms of the underlying medical costs of providing that care. The last thing I want to touch on is reinsurance. So the state has a reinsurance program, or what we call the premium security plan, and this helps health insurance carriers keep premiums lower through an offset of high-cost claims in the individual market. So this has been incredibly important this past year. Typically, we see an impact of around 20% with the program, and this year, in part because of all the changes on the federal side and what that means for the individual market, we're seeing an impact closer to 47%. The program is funded this year it's funded through a state appropriation, and then next year we have funding through an assessment on the group health carriers, and after that our program expires, so we need to apply for a new waiver. Now I'll turn it over to Minshur to talk more, and Erica to talk more about what they're seeing in the market.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record.
My name is Erica Helvick-Anderson. I'm the Senior Director of Public Affairs at Minshur. And we've just come off of our open enrollment period, and we wanted to provide a snapshot of what we're seeing of the effects of some of the items that Deputy Commissioner Dreyer talked about. Early indications are pointing to the loss of enhanced tax credits are materially affecting enrollment behavior and affordability. In terms of signups, which is a number we've heard in the past, we are down 3%, so 162,000 signups this year. But signups don't tell the whole story. Signups include new consumers and passive enrollments. Think of it as anyone who signed up at any point in time for 2026 coverage. It does not remove cancellations. So that number has been one we've used historically because you're able to pull that earlier in open enrollment to start seeing how we're doing on trends. But what I want to also talk about is what changes have also occurred when we dig deeper into the numbers. New consumers coming to MinSure dropped by 40% this year, nearly 18,000 fewer people. Households eligible for tax credit fell from 61% last year to just over 50% this year due to the removal of the enhanced tax credits. The January effectuated coverage is down 6%, so effectuated coverage would be those who've paid their premiums. Active enrollees are down 8% compared to last year. Active enrollees would be those who have a December 31st, 2026 end date for their coverage. Cancellation and terminations have increased by 47%. To say that a different way, about 15% of enrollees canceled coverage during our open enrollment. That is up from 10% last year. I do want to note that MinSure knows that people cancel for a number of reasons, not just affordability. Also could be that they've gained access to employer-sponsored healthcare. These are early numbers, but the trend appears to be clear. We are seeing some consequences from the loss of enhanced tax credit. Minnesotans are trying hard to stay covered. Plan switching increased by 87% this year. Over 80% of those who switched chose a lower premium plan. 52% who switched stayed at the same metal level. So if they were silver, they stayed at silver. They stayed at bronze, but were able to find a cheaper option in their area. We saw a 112% increase in consumers buying down. So we did see movement of people buying down metal levels. Consumers were actively managing their affordability is what this tells us. We also get to see a little bit deeper into some early analysis of demographic trends. About 21% of our enrollees age 55 plus changed plans. That was the highest age group that switched plans. Younger adults, 18 to 34, had a slightly higher disenrollment rate than other age groups. We are watching this closely and communicating with our colleagues at other agencies since it affects the overall health and stability of the individual market. We also saw an open enrollment saw an increase in demand from MinSure services. We saw website and we saw record interest. Website traffic was higher than ever. Calls and appointments with brokers and navigators increased. Minnesotans wanted to stay covered. They just needed coverage to be within their reach. Looking ahead, we expect continued enrollment volatility this year. We may see monthly attribution attrition as families reassess their budgets. So we're going to be looking closely at those rates. People effectuate cover month to month to see what trends we see. But early indicators point to that the loss of enhanced tax credits affected enrollee behavior. So I also want to touch on a little bit more about the operational side. This was the busiest open enrollment year we've seen since 2018. The primary driver appears to be the loss of enhanced tax credits and the premiums increases, and Minnesotans who are worried about affordability, and they reached out to us in record numbers. Our contact center saw 134,000 calls during open enrollment. That is a 42% increase over last year. Across all lines, the total was up almost 30%, which is roughly 60,000 higher than 2 years ago. Mainline calls were nearly double what we saw 2 years ago. We also saw a really great use of technology. Our courtesy callback requests increased by 72% this year. So those are folks who they call, we let them know that there's going to be a wait, and they ask for a call back instead of having to have the phone right there with them. They can wait for the call back. And we were able to get a 98% connectivity rate after and reconnected with those folks. This reflects a contact center that stepped up under real pressure. And we really appreciate the work that they did for Minnesota. At the end of the day, these numbers represent Minnesota families making tough choices. We saw record engagement because Minnesotans value health coverage. They shopped, they compared, they tried to make it work. But affordability appears to be part of what is determined in sustaining coverage. Our team managed unprecedented demand and improved performance under pressure. We remain focused on our mission, ensuring Minnesotans have access to affordable health coverage. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is the end of the presentation for the insurance side. Okay, so we can move to member questions. I was kind of curious on slide four of the, you had mentioned consolidation, and I was just kind of curious if you guys are tracking how that's actually affecting services to people. I know in my area they've consolidated a lot, and we no longer have, you know, mother-baby center in our community hospital, and a lot of the community services have been taken out of the community hospital. And so is there any tracking on how that's actually affecting outcomes or patients? I mean, that's probably Department of Health, huh?
Chair Cagle, that's a great question. So, yes, some of that is within the Department of Health, and I'm sure they can speak more to the health outcomes piece of it. I mean, we certainly do look at it in terms of what it means for costs and insurance, and with in terms of networks and making sure that there is an adequate network for people.
Have we seen costs go down with consolidation? Is that a trend that you can see?
Yeah, I would say in general costs are increasing because of consolidation, but again, there's a lot of variability within that.
Thank you. And then I think I had one more question before we get. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had to step out for just a second, so if I missed it, I apologize. But maybe one of the testifiers could help me. Did you cover any of the potential increases in costs that might be due to mandates? If that was covered, like I said, maybe I just didn't hear that, but I know in 23-24 we had, I believe, 14 new mandates that might have impacted those things. If you could maybe help me, then yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Sure. Chair Cagle, Representative. So, yes, there were several new mandates. So there is an impact on rates because of new mandates, and where you see most of that impact would be in the small group market. The individual market is many of those mandates, and particularly some of the higher cost ones, are defrayed through state appropriations for that. But the larger driver of cost is really, or larger driver of the rate increases is really healthcare costs, not the new benefit mandates.
President Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have a ballpark idea what the increase that we could attribute to mandates might be?
Mr.
Chair. Representative, I would need to get back to you with that exact number.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I wasn't listening close enough to get your names, but real quick, I have two questions, if that's possible, Madam Chair. The first one is, we're talking cost, and we always hear cost. And I'm curious if the state or your department has the ability to dig down into an audit, and are the providers transparent on what costs they're talking about? I love it when I hear that our costs are raising, but what cost is raising? The Representative Heinzman had a good point. Is it regulations, or is it nursing, or is it all of the above? But I want the details, because if we're making decisions and we're having issues with this, let's try to work on this together. Is that a possibility? Do you do this, or is it kind of not as transparent as I'm hoping for here?
Ms. Dreyer.
Representative Cagle, Representative. So in terms of when we're looking at rates, we aren't always looking at that underlying base information. That's not to say that information doesn't exist. I know our colleagues at Department of Health and others around the state are looking at provider costs in more detail. There are also transparency rules that the federal government requires in terms of hospital price transparency.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, yeah, I'm kind of confused on that answer because I think we should be digging into this even with Department of Health or whoever. But I get sick of everything getting blamed on cost, but no, show me the meat. And then the last one is, I'm wondering in our data that you're saying that some people are dropping, some people are in your program. Do we have any information on geographical data around the state so we can pin it to county? And then I'd like to see geographical data based on population versus how many in that population are covered by the product or how many are covered by or not covered. Do we have any of that information? Is it possible to get it?
Deputy Commissioner?
Definitely possible to get the regional data. I could check with our data team if we can drill down to county. I would assume we can. I only highlighted things that seemed like we didn't see large differences between regions, so I didn't call that out in the slides, but we can go over those numbers.
Representative Hewitt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I would like the committee at least get it to the chairs so we can all look at that information. That'd be great. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Katizo-Tune.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for this overview today. I think it's really helpful to all of us as we can kind of consider what next steps to take. I thought it was also really informative that you had mentioned like that 400% of the federal poverty line. It's around $60,000 a year for an individual. And of course, that kind of goes up or down depending on how many people you have in your household, how many children. But I just did some, you know, quick back of the napkin math, aka my cell phone calculator, because I can't do math in my head anymore. And so people who are earning $60,000 a year are earning about $28 an hour. And so when we look at the evidence that you have, that data based on people changing their plans to something slightly more affordable, but at that same level, but then other folks who are going down a level, they're going down in service, they're going down in accessibility, they're going down in cost, because they are debating the risk that they are willing to take in their household, that someone in their family gets a cancer diagnosis or gets into a car accident or you name it, right? It's really important to remember that Minnesotans do not have actuaries on staff like the health insurance companies do to tell them what that risk is. My family's an outlier. I do have an actuary on staff. however, I think it's really important to consider that health insurance companies have somebody to tell them, hey, this is what we're looking at, and what do those companies take into consideration then? I mean, we have for-profit insurance, we have not-for-profit insurance, and a lot of this has been kind of a statement to kind of get us to think a little bit, but I think it's always really helpful for not only the people in the room, but also Minnesotans who might be tuning in today and have never watched a presentation on our market here in Minnesota. Can you just explain what is the difference between not-for-profit healthcare and for-profit healthcare and what the layout of the lay of the land is here in Minnesota?
Deputy Commissioner?
Chair Cagle, Representative. In terms of what we do on a day-to-day basis and what we're looking at for rates and, you know, looking at the financial viability of a company to be able to pay for claims, that day-to-day work is the same no matter if a company is a nonprofit or a for-profit.
Representative Katizo-Tune.
Thank you, and thank you for that. So that just kind of goes to my point about households having to cut corners in different areas of their budget, right? So if somebody's making $28 an hour and a copay is $35 and they're trying to weigh whether or not they're going to take their kid to the doctor, they have to work more than an hour to pay just for the copay. And that doesn't take into consideration their later share, what's going to go toward their deductible, all of that. They're balancing, you know, what are we going to have for dinner this week? They're balancing, are my kids going to be able to sign up for after school activities? They're balancing, are we going to be able to take a vacation this year? Maybe, right? And I think it's important that we look at household budgets and then
get some information from the health insurance companies, because what does their budget look like, right? Like, are they looking at executive compensation? Are they making adjustments there? Because that's what parents are thinking about. They're like, how am I going to make these things work, and how am I going to move it around? They have been counting on these enhanced premium tax credits from the federal government. Now this money's been taken away, but guess what? The insurance companies are still getting support from the federal government. And I just think that it's really important that we ground ourselves in the fact that the work that we do is to help Minnesotans and not to, you know, give taxpayer money to insurance companies so that they can continue to pay their executives grand sums of money when Minnesotans are pinching pennies. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Or thank you, Representative. Sorry, it's still early. Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Testifiers, quick question is, what mechanisms does MNsure actually have in place right now to give notification to members that are utilizing their services of potential subsidy adjustments for future adjustments?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Ms. Helvick Anderson.
Representative, so we used all of our marketing, so earned media, we used our own strategies. So we emailed, we sent notices, we tried to be very clear that there was a change coming and that they should shop and compare early, which we were glad that Minnesotans took that, because even if they were able to adjust slightly, at least they were able to find some savings. So we had a robust outreach plan to try to reach all of our enrollees.
Representative Dotson?
Madam Chair. Notification, what type of timeline is the notification period? How far in advance do you notify individuals of that change?
So Anderson? When they came into open enrollment, they had it in their system ready for the open enrollment timing. So that would have been right around October for November 1st, where they could start making the decision, and they had to decide by December 15th for January 1 coverage and January 15th for February 1st coverage.
So I'm hearing you say the 30 days, could we maybe look at maybe advancing that timeline of notification?
So that was the official notice. We did do some media and some other emails, just like softer outreaches, so that they were aware starting in the summer that there were changes coming, but that we didn't have the full data set until, because we'd have rates finalized, and then we were able to share what they had. So part of it is just the cycle, but we did do as much as we could to outreach early that a change was coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Van Bindensbergen.
Hey, you did great.
Awesome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question in regards to the individual market. You know, it looks like there's 3.2 or 3.1% of Minnesotans on the individual market. Where was that 10 years ago, that number? Any idea where that's went?
Deputy Commissioner?
Chair Cagle, Representative, let me see if I can pull that number up for you.
Jeopardy music.
Doo-doo. Do you know how many people that represents? I believe I've got a lot of those kinds of, a lot of people like that in my district. I got farmers, mm-hmm. Self-employed people, and yep. You're telling me the rates went up 21% this year, correct?
Deputy Commissioner?
Chair,
sorry.
We have roughly 187,000 Minnesotans in the individual market. Again, still trying to understand what the impact was for 2026 at this point to see what sort of decrease there may be. But yes, it is a small but important part of our market.
Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So where I'm assuming if you went back 10, 15 years, that the individual market, those numbers would be a lot higher. Where have those people went to?
Deputy Commissioner?
Chair Cagle, a representative. So at the peak, our individual market was around 300,000-ish. Don't quote me on that number. But we did see, we don't know exactly where those individuals go. We hope that they find coverage in the individual market or in the employer market or coverage in some other program. Again, like throughout that time, like our uninsured rate has decreased as well. So we're assuming that in most cases, people have found support of coverage.
Any follow-up?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I'm going to follow up on the sentiment that Representative Tizu Batum was talking about. When the department is evaluating insurance rates. Are you using purely actuarial data, or is the affordability of Minnesotans a factor that the department takes into account?
Deputy Commissioner?
Chair Cagle, Representative Smith. And that's a great question. So when we're looking at rates, we're really looking at are the rates actuarially justified? So that is very much an actuarial calculation to make sure that companies are charging enough and aren't charging too much, right? So we don't want a distortion in the market. When we're thinking about affordability, that really gets to what people are paying, and that is both a factor of what they're eligible for in terms of tax credits, as well as where they live and other sorts of what sort of health plan they choose. So that is a more complicated but still important conversation that we tend to have with colleagues in MNsure and others in the other health agencies around the state.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that answer. So, I mean, I heard actuarial is sort of the focus from the department perspective. From a legislative question, is that a statutorial requirement, or is that something that is a department position as you are, again, evaluating these rates?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Cagle, Representative. So we're required to review rates under federal law.
Representative Smith.
But specifically, is that I do understand that. When you evaluate them, are you able to take into account affordability? Say, for example, actuarial data that you were given by these companies, you look at them and say, you know, at the end of the day, we represent the people of Minnesota. They can't continue to afford these increases in premiums. We are actually going to approve rates lower than you are asking for, these companies are asking for. Is that something you could legally do? Or is there something in statute keeping you from doing that?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Cagle, Representative Smith. So again, like our actuaries have to abide by their own actuarial standards to make sure that they're reviewing the rates in that sense. When we're talking about affordability, those move into policy questions and conversations in terms of us, for example, advocating for a reinsurance program or other sorts of measures that help to lower costs for people. But in terms of the actuarial piece, that is like making sure that the companies are providing information that is justified and sound and reasonable and not discriminatory.
I have a follow-up on that, if that's okay. So when you're looking at those rates, do you look at the insurer's overall budget to get a snapshot of where their money is going and if they're putting exorbitant amounts of money to executive salary versus putting it back into the medical loss ratio? Is that something that the department evaluates as well?
Sure, Chair Cagle, that's a great question. So again, when we're looking at rates, we're just looking at the individual market. And like, so we're looking market by market and looking at that data for that individual, like those actuarial trends. When we're thinking about medical loss ratio, that takes, like we're looking at that, but that there are requirements that say that health insurance companies have to spend a certain amount of their premium dollars on actual medical claims. So we do evaluate that as well. And again, those plans, MLRs, or medical loss ratios have been in the high 90s for the past
years. So when you're looking at it, you're only looking at it from the premiums and not looking at it from other sources of income that the insurance companies are getting? It's just strictly the premiums? Mm-hmm.
Chair Cagle, so in terms of the medical, I just want to make sure I'm
I mean, so when you're evaluating the their plan or, you know, their rate increases, mm-hmm. Are we looking at, so the medical loss ratio, they set it based on how much premiums are covering the services, correct?
So, yes, when we're looking at rates, we're looking at, like, what the costs are going to be in future years to provide that care. And when we're looking at that, we're saying, are you charging enough? Like, are your rates going to be enough to cover that projected cost of care? So we're looking at projections. The medical loss ratio is a more retrospective look mm-hmm. when we're thinking about, have the health plans been doing what they're supposed to be doing and putting their premium dollars where they're supposed to be putting it?
I guess my question is then, we know that insurance companies have other sources of income as well, mm-hmm. and so investment accounts on reserves and things like that. And so is that money being taken into account when it comes to setting rates as well and looking at their overall money they're pulling in and then what it costs to actually cover the services, if that makes any sense?
Representative, so I mean, we certainly look at like those components of health, like what health insurance companies are doing and how they're doing financially, like their overall financial health. But in terms of the rates, again, like we're looking at their projections and their ability to pay moving forward.
Got it. Thank you, Representative Smith. Yes, sorry.
No, those are great questions. Thank you, Chair. Also, you can do whatever you want. You're the chair.
Well,
as I've been told many times.
That far.
thank you. I would just kind of close the loop on that. I just think we talk a lot about regulation, obviously, in this committee and with your department, and I would advocate for regulation in this space, including the voice of Minnesotans, which I think we would all say are saying that health insurance is too high. And health insurance companies generally, whether for-profit or nonprofit, are making too much money off of the healthcare industry. And I think we need to take that more into account when we are approving these plan rates. But the obvious larger problem, and now I'm just getting into a comment, is the pie chart here on page 3 of this presentation. It's how Minnesotans get their healthcare. We're talking about reinsurance. Reinsurance is about mitigating risk from high claim consumers, but we already have a way to do that. The way to do that is for everyone to be in a larger group alleviating risk. If you look at the pie chart on 3, we have 20% of Minnesotans that are getting Medicare. Medicare is obviously usually high-risk individuals, older individuals who know use healthcare more than younger individuals. Those are being paid by those folks who are working primarily. It's through a payroll tax primarily. And then there's this large group, about 50% of Minnesotans, that are receiving their insurance primarily through their work. It's the largest group. But they're also paying into Medicare. So they're essentially paying twice for health care, although, of course, they will enjoy those benefits later on, and those health care insurance won't have to pay once they become higher risk. Then there's the medical assistance, which also is subsidized by public dollars. Then there's MinCare, which is subsidized by state and federal dollars. Then there's this small ish group, but it's very important, the individual market that we're talking about here, that is now subsidized by our reinsurance, which is also state and federal money. The answer to all of this, I think, is pretty clear, is to have one single large healthcare provider where everyone is paying into the same pot, because the only group that is benefiting from these picked off little areas that are trying to survive on their own is the insurance companies that are getting subsidized by public dollars while also charging people high costs, and then throw in the fact that they're doing this integrated model, which really means that they're trying to monopolize the healthcare industry. So I don't think the title of today was the state of insurance in Minnesota. So I feel like I had to take a moment to say the problem is that we are not allowing people to be together and paying together into what I would say is the best possible way we could do healthcare, which is a single payer healthcare system. And Minnesotans are hurting from that, as we heard today, having to change their healthcare insurance in higher numbers than we have seen and paying higher numbers than we have seen previously. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Falconer.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for this presentation, the information. I just trying to organize my chicken scratch scribble notes here in my head, lifetime. Just a general comment from page, what number is this, 12, with the year-over-year comparison. I guess I'm just really shocked, sad, disheartened, worried about the percentage change. None of these are good numbers. 3% down, 40, 10. The only number that went up are the number of people that canceled or terminated their plans. Percentages are one thing, but I think, you know, as we're debating public policy and what we can do about this, I just really want to be focusing on that these are people's lives, their families. As Representative Katsiza Watun said, they're debating whether or not they're going to take a vacation or have a healthy dinner or go to the doctor. Myself, certainly before, we all enjoy the state health insurance program, incredibly generous. Before this, my family of five deductible was close to $25,000, and we were paying, I think, $18,000 in just for basic coverage, which has covered checkup and few immunizations. So these numbers are startling when we know the economy, for as Chair Cagle said, is not being felt in people's pocketbooks in their homes. That these numbers to me tend to indicate that we are rapidly, at least quicker than I would like, approaching a crisis in who's able to have coverage. From the pie chart that Representative Smith referenced, and we've got 4.6% of Minnesotans that have no coverage. Again, I just want to talk in like in real people metrics. That's the 2024 population. Again, just quick math on my calculator: 5.84 million people in Minnesota. That's nearly 250,000 Minnesotans that don't have insurance at all. What happens to them? They still need care. And so part of what, I guess, the question I'm trying to get to is, when you're looking into what plans are going to cost in the future, does that take into account the number of people that just dropped their insurance? Then they have to either delay care, making when they do finally get care much more expensive in the ER, which, as we all know, shifts costs to the hospitals, the clinics, or back to taxpayers, or does that also then, like, for when you come back to us and talk about what the 2027 changes, are you considering the amount of people that can't afford that are going to continue to drop off? Because if rates went up this year drastically, this many people dropped, what is it going to do next year, given the costs that are going to be imparted into the system from people not being able to afford care, and those costs being absorbed by the system regardless, particularly taxpayers and rate increases. Do you have any idea where we're headed in the future? If you're watching trend lines, what is next year's outlook going to be? How many people are going to be dropping? How expensive are rates going to be? And if we don't have transparency, like Representative Hewitt said, or if it's mandates, like Representative Heinzman said, where are the costs headed? Where are we going with this?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Cagle. We don't know, right? And also, I would say that rates are going to continue to go up if people help, particularly if healthy people continue to drop coverage. And again, we don't know the full impact of everything at this point. We're still looking at that. That said, if projections continue to go in this direction, it's not looking good for the individual market.
Thank you. And I know, did you follow?
Yeah, just one quick follow-up. Thanks for that. I guess that's just kind of my point. As this committee is talking about rate increases, as we address what we're consistently hearing about affordability in people's lives, I just hope that we can come up with solutions together that are going to actually work toward keeping costs low, but then also having plans that are going to provide the coverage as well. I mean, you can have a plan, but then still have an insanely high deductible that if you get hit by a car, you're going to lose your house anyway. So what's the point of even paying that premium? I think that's why people are deciding to take that risk and drop their plans. And that's not where I want Minnesotans to be.
And it looks like we did have a pinch hitter come up. If you'd like to introduce yourself and give some testimony, I think we'll go about 5 more minutes on this and then move on to our next presentation.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Stefan Gildemeister. I direct the Health Economics Program in the Department of Health, and I'm the state health economist, and my legislative lead suggested that I come up and offer our services to the committee. Many of the questions that you've come up are tough for the regulators, but they're sort of in our wheelhouse. So given how little time you have, all I want to maybe say is that we're happy to talk about the effect of consolidation generally and the work that Minnesota is doing in that space. I'm also happy to talk a little bit about the cost of healthcare in Minnesota and what drives healthcare spending, what we know and what we're working on better understanding and maybe what the partner of our work, the Center for Healthcare Affordability, does to identify policy options for the legislature to consider. Also, and I, Assistant Commissioner Dreyer is right, it's really hard to know what the future brings. But I wanted to make you aware that Minnesota does a survey of health access every 2 years, and we use that to understand the sources of insurance coverage people have, to understand the challenges Minnesotans face with regard to access to care. And that work is forthcoming in not too long of a time. And then finally, we're working with a group to model the effect of the forthcoming changes to Medicaid, to the enhanced subsidy, the loss of reinsurance on the health insurance market in Minnesota, and expect definitely higher premiums, less coverage, and more uninsured. And we hope to wrap up that analysis in not too long a time either.
Thank you. I'll move to questions from Representative Allen and then Representative Hansen and then Chair O'Driscoll, and we'll move on after that one. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question was to the panel. I mean, we're going through that list there, seeing a 3% change, 40% change, 10% change, 6% change, 8% change. As far as your information or your data goes, can you tell us exactly where those people ended up going? Did they just opt out not to have insurance with you, or did they actually switch over and maybe they got a job that actually had insurance that's covering them and they're coming off of your plan? Do you have the any data behind that?
Assistant Commissioner,
Representative.
Ms. Anderson or Ms. Helvig Anderson?
You can just use Anderson.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Mincher only knows that they left our space. We don't, unless they somehow self-report to us, which we do not get consistently. So that's where we partner with our friends at. The Health Department does a survey of the uninsured market, and then Commerce, so other people in the world get close to the number, but we need our whole ecosystem.
Representative Allen?
So if we really want to look at these numbers as far as change and what's happened, it's just kind of, I look at numbers on a regular basis. Data is what drives us in agriculture and what we do. And if we're not understanding where these people are going and what's happening, it's kind of, it gives me the impression that, you know, there could be people getting their insurance from other locations. Just to assume that they're not reinsuring with you doesn't mean they're not getting insurance. So it's just kind of a statement, I guess, and it would be just nice to have more clarity on that before we really start digging into the numbers and get a misunderstanding or a misrepresentation of exactly what's going on within the insurance markets that are happening and specifically with this program. So thank you.
Yeah, and I think you'd mentioned, too, that uninsurance rates are still going down, and so we're still seeing people in the market, but we just don't know where. Is that what I kind of heard from you earlier, Assistant Commissioner?
Chair Cagle, it's based on retrospective
sure.
Information. So, okay. Again, I know our colleagues at the Department of Health have been.
We'll see that information next year to see where they went, if we have the uninsured rates still going down.
Unfortunately, we have flags and data.
If only we had that crystal ball. Representative Hansen, and then we added Representative Davids, and then we'll go to O'Driscoll, I promise.
Thank you, Chair. I heard you mention that the tax credit changes were parts of the, you know, most impactful federal changes, but I was just curious if you could, are there like other top three or the other big ones that you could just really highlight clearly for us? Maybe to help us think of things we could possibly do here other than reinsurance to help, you know, reduce the number of uninsured folks, to better support our small business owners, to better support independent contractors, self-employed people who don't necessarily always have access to the more affordable plans at like a large group would.
Who wants to take that one? Ms. Helvick Anderson or Deputy Commissioner, whoever.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have, say that.
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Cagle, maybe I can start and then I'll
I assumed you were going to do it. So.
I'll let Helvick Anderson hop in. So there are a couple different types of changes that we're seeing from the federal government, mostly in terms of rules, in terms so they fall into buckets of how people enroll in coverage, and so a lot of that comes into how can we make MnSure work even more efficiently and more effectively than, so like IT upgrades, more money into helping people navigate through their insurance options, that sort of thing. The other piece is really around changes to benefit structure, and we'll say like there was just a proposed rule that came out earlier this month, so we're still digging into that one, and that includes a variety of changes in terms of what health insurance companies are able to do in the market, and we're still trying to figure out what opportunities or challenges there may be within that proposed rule. So more to come on that.
And Madam Chair, Representative, looking forward, so the main cost driver for or main change that we saw in effect this year was the sunsetting of the enhanced APTC. We are bracing for other changes that we think will affect enrollment in terms mostly in terms of how people can show and be re-enrolled each year. Those barriers we know sometimes also lead to a loss of, and that, but that won't be coming until next year, and then some of these more roll out over years. So in terms of this year, on the MnSure marketplace, we're mostly seeing the rate increases from the, you know, external pressures that Deputy Commissioner Dreyer spoke to, and then the sunsetting of the enhanced APTC.
Madam Chair. Hansen? Madam Chair, if I can add a point, it's maybe helpful to remember that healthcare, like any product, is the spending on it is really a function of the price, what do we pay for it, and how much do we use it. That is the basis on top of which we then layer financing, administrative requirements, documentation, et cetera. It's helpful to remember that the price of healthcare rises faster than our income, than inflation, than the pace of the economy. So we are moving the cost of healthcare, spending on healthcare, drives faster than our income. So there's a gap, there's tension developing. And on top of that, and this is the point my colleagues have made, there are now other complications or changes to what we got used to, and that is pretty disruptive to a small market. But I think what we're talking about with regard to the individual market is what we also see in other marketplaces. The cost of healthcare for Medicare has been rising. The cost of spending on Medicaid is under pricing pressure. Spending for the group market, what employers pay for their employees, has been rising. These pricing pressures exist because of the cost of healthcare. In addition, I think what we've been observing the last few years is that the slowing of healthcare consumption quantity has been reversed. So there is more use of healthcare services. And Deputy Commissioner Dreyer mentioned that with regard to prescription drug, GLP-1s, et cetera. So you have kind of a, don't quote me on this, but it feels a bit like a perfect storm.
Thank you, Mr. Gildemeister. Representative Davids?
Thanks so much, Madam Chair. This is a question for a nonpartisan researcher. I'm just trying to get this straight. So the for-profit companies are not allowed in Minnesota's individual market. Is that correct?
Ms. Pompeo?
Chair and members, I am not aware of the current statutes. There was a hold placed a couple of years ago. Perhaps Ms. Dreyer can help us with this.
Ms. Dreyer?
Chair Cagle, I believe that rule applies to HMOs selling in the or NCOs, managed care organizations, selling Medicaid in the state.
Sure. Okay.
Representative Davids?
That makes sense. Then, so really then they don't get any reinsurance monies because they're not in that market.
Deputy Commissioner?
Chair Cagle, I mean, I would need to double check on courts. I think they are a for-profit, but I to double check.
We're going to follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Perfect. Thank you. Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this couple of questions for Commissioner Joris, if I could. On the third page in the handout that you gave us today, in the header on it says, distribution of Minnesota population by primary insurance coverage 2024. For the benefit of the committee, since we're coming back and we have new members that are on here, can you just review with us very quickly, when we do mandates in the state of Minnesota, which of the plans that are highlighted in this diagram are affected by the mandates? And I'll kind of get it started. I'm assuming that the 49.3% large group is the ERISA exempt, and so those mandates wouldn't apply there. Am I correct on that?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Cagle, Representative O'Driscoll. So I believe this chart, the large group, includes both fully insured and self-insured. And so it's roughly a two-thirds self-funded, one-third fully insured. So I'd say about a third of that 50%.
I'm sorry, a third of that is what?
About roughly like between 20 and 30% of that 50% is impacted by the mandates.
Okay, sure, then Medicare and medical assistance, since those are federally influenced programs, do the mandates that the state of Minnesota puts on policies and coverage affect those as well?
Deputy Commissioner.
Chair Cagle, Representative O'Driscoll. So the state mandated benefits impact the individual market, the small group market, the fully insured large group market, and then frequently they also impact CGIP, and then sometimes it's written in that it also applies to the Medicaid market, but that is a different part of the bill.
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason I asked that question is one of the things that I think is, as I'm hearing testimony from everybody today, I think we can all agree that there is an issue with the market and with health insurance and reimbursement, and just kind of that's what we're facing right now. And that's a product is we're living longer, healthier, and happier, which I am 100% in favor of. But when you look at the fact that the people who can least afford the mandates are the persons who we're concerned about in the individual market, or persons who have limited income or don't have resources available for them in the way of insurance through an employer. And I just want to make sure that the committee understands that every time we pass a mandate and it becomes part of the law, without defrayment where the state of Minnesota would pick up the additional cost of that, it gets moved into the cost of the premium calculation that these individuals are going to pay. And you can't buy a policy and says, I'd like to buy 25 of the 30 mandates that are in there, or only want two of those 30 mandates that are there. What might be helpful in the affordability of insurance is to find a way to influence public policy that says an individual can buy a policy if they want that has none of the state prescribed mandates in there, or only a certain amount of those, unless there is defrayment that's available. Because that's what the killer is going to be. And Chair Katiza Watun brought up a great point. $28 an hour, and you're paying costs for copays or deductibles that are on here. And a lot of that's maybe on coverage that you and your family don't particularly want or need. It's sort of like where Representative Cagle was talking about her grandmother told her when she was growing up two words, that's sinful. Well, my grandma, when I wanted a full banana, I wanted the entire banana, and she said, nope, a half a banana is better than no banana at all. And so when you think about that in the context of what we're talking about here, the full banana is the policy with all the mandates in it. And for some folks, a half a banana without all of those mandates in there to cover their basic health costs is exactly what the doctor ordered. We know that when people go to urgent care or to the emergency room, it's the most expensive and costly care. So if we can find a way to buffer that so that people can have the comfort of insurance to go to a clinic where the services are going to be delivered at a more reasonable rate than in the urgent care or the emergency room environment, we all win on that. The other thing that I'm going to ask the question, and I got to tell you, I'm just a little disappointed. Because I had talked to you, Commissioner, about where do we have these increases, right? We were all publicly saying, hey, you know what, reinsurance did this, and rates were affected, and here's how much we were saving in different kinds of things. And I had asked, can we get an idea of the number of policies that are issued through MNsure or the private market in these different categories? And I never got an answer. So I followed up again, and the meeting was scheduled, and it was canceled. And we asked today to have that information for this meeting for the benefit of the committee. And from what I can see, we didn't get it. That is very important information to me, and I think to the commission and to the committee, because if we have 10 people who are receiving a 65% increase in premiums, that tells us one thing. But if you have 10,000 people who are receiving a 65% increase, that tells us something else. And I think that that is an important cornerstone for us to have in this discussion and decision-making process. Madam Chair, thank you, and members.
Thank you. And I would also just like to add, too, I would love to see an evaluation of how much billing codes cost in the process, and how the fact that each insurance company has like 50 different plans with 50 different billing codes for 50 different services, and how much labor and time we waste on just trying to decode billing codes, and if there is a way to standardize that or figure out a way just to make it an easier process so that it wouldn't be such a labor-intensive endeavor to try and bill somebody. Thank you all, and I'm sure we will be hitting you up, Mr. Gildemeister, for some more information, as well as the rest of you probably throughout the legislative session. So I appreciate you coming and testifying here. And with that, we will move to the Consumer Protection Restitution Account Overview. And so I will welcome our testifiers up from the Attorney General's Office. So with us, we have Jessica Whitney, who's Deputy Attorney General, and Thomas Elness from ARP. And if anybody else up there would like to introduce themselves, go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Jessica Whitney, Deputy Attorney General from the Attorney General's Office. We are going to present on the Consumer Protection Restitution Account, but we're going to let AARP go first.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Elness. If you could just introduce yourself and then make sure to get that mic close to you and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Cagle, Chair O'Driscoll, and committee members. My name is Thomas Elness, and I serve as the Associate State Director of Advocacy with AARP Minnesota on behalf of our more than 620,000 members and older adults across our state. AARP is a nonpartisan nonprofit organization that helps strengthen communities, promote healthy living, and empowers people to choose how they live as they age. Thank you for your interest in learning about the nation's first consumer fraud restitution fund of its kind that you helped enact last session. Thank you to our bipartisan authors, including our House lead author, Representative Liz Lee, our bipartisan authors and champions, and the Attorney General's Office for their work on this fund. The impact of scams and consumer fraud is profound, especially when older adults are at a time in their life when they are least able to recover financially. AARP is helping to lead the effort to protect Minnesotans from consumer fraud through community education, the AARP Fraud Watch Network, and also through policy changes at every level of government. Last year, we set out to address a problem that many scam victims experience, and that's that few viable options exist for recovering money lost to scams. Minnesota's new Consumer Fraud Restitution Fund is already helping to address this problem in three key ways. First, the fund creates more incentive for scam victims to report fraud to law enforcement and the Attorney General's office. Too often, defrauded Minnesotans do not report the crimes they've experienced because of shame, guilt, or fear. But with an increased chance of restitution, defrauded Minnesotans have more reason to report their cases, which will help the state and law enforcement catch and hold more criminals accountable. Second, the fund gives the Attorney General's office more incentive to pursue these cases. Without the chance of restitution in many scam cases, attorneys general across the country often prioritize other cases. Third, and most obvious, is that this fund will provide financial recovery to those who lost funds to criminals, in some cases their entire life savings, which could mean the difference between getting back on their feet or depending entirely on public support. So I just want to close by thanking you for making this innovative and transformational idea a reality. It's going to be life-changing for Minnesota victims of frauds and scams, and something that I hope you are proud to have helped create for the state of Minnesota. Lastly, just please know that AARP is seeking your help in doing more to root out these scams in our state to begin with. In the days and weeks ahead, I'm looking forward to partnering with each of you to share some ideas on how we can prevent more scams that are impacting our state. And I thank you for your attention to this issue, your commitment to working in a bipartisan way to solve real problems, and I'm happy to stand by for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Whitney. All right. Good morning. Chair Cagle, Chair Driscoll, and the committee, thanks for having us here. This is a work in progress, so this is sort of your halfway update. As a reminder, the Consumer Protection Restitution Account, which we in the AG's office have taken to calling CIPRA because a government agency has never met an acronym we don't like to shorten. So CIPRA was, as you all know, it was a bipartisan bill to help pay eligible consumers for whom restitution was not possible. And you can see on the slide, if you want to get technical, what an eligible consumer is. And as Thomas has mentioned, it was passed last session in a bipartisan bill. We have started doling out restitution for this. So first of all, how is it funded? Just a reminder, we take 50% of all money recovered by the AGO, by our office, in consumer enforcement actions, up to $5 million each year. And then we also use restitution funds that can't be feasibly distributed to relevant consumers or for whom consumers have not claimed restitution. That must be deposited into CIPRA as well. As of a week ago, $4.6 million had gone into the fund since July 1, 2025. The lion's share of that had come from a Johnson & Johnson settlement, a settlement against Johnson & Johnson involving talcum powder. So how do consumers get access to it? Consumers file complaints with the AGO after being scammed. There's the little link to file a complaint on our office. You can also call our office and get all that information. We also get cases from other sources. Sometimes you all bring us cases. Folks in the audience bring us cases. We learn about cases from other government agencies. But regardless, we get a complaint in our office or a case in our office, and we pursue it. We pursue the case, and we obtain a court order. That's critical. To access CIPRA, you have to have that court order. It's nothing we can just decide to dole out on our own. So we must go into court to get restitution. The form of the court order, for those legal folks out there, it can be what's known as an assurance of discontinuance, a consent judgment, or just your ordinary old plain court order. We then determine if defendants have funds to pay victims. So we pursue collection efforts, or if the defendants are in bankruptcy, we look at our claim chances in bankruptcy. Or if we don't know the defendants and they're a John Doe because they're one of those true scam artists that may not even be living in the U.S. and likely are not, we make that decision. So we need to spend some time ascertaining that there are no collectible funds. I think if we didn't do that, we'd run afoul of some accounting issues. So then, pursuant to the statute, we must distribute the CIPRA funds in chronological order based on final date of the court order. So our first up, and one that we heard from many folks on this committee and we know impacted many constituents across districts, was Woodbury Dental Arts. Just a reminder of what this was. It's a now defunct dental clinic. The dentist at issue had had his license suspended multiple times and was still continuing to practice despite having his license pulled. He took tens of thousands of dollars in upfront fees. Millions of dollars in upfront fees is what it ended up being. He promptly shut down in March 2024 without any advance notice, leaving patients without access to their dental records, dental products. For example, we had, unfortunately, many folks without their dentures, essentially without teeth for long periods of time and having spent tens of thousands of dollars to get them. The Woodbury Dental Arts promptly filed for bankruptcy, and there were definitely insufficient funds to compensate consumers. So in November, we entered into one of those court orders, an assurance of discontinuance with the bankruptcy trustee who was monitoring the estate of Woodbury Dental Arts. And we tried to get a number for all sums paid by the clinic, but as you can imagine, the clinic had not kept good records. So that number was not readily ascertainable. We knew it was north of $5 million. We were estimating $5.4 million. But again, we didn't know how much of that was outstanding to consumers, how many consumers had gotten restituted by their insurance companies, how many consumers had gotten loans forgiven. We didn't even have complete records, so we initiated a claims process a few months ago to try and identify eligible claimants. And you can see there's the start of our claim form. It's closed, but if you have any constituents that are still out there, or if anyone in the audience knows anyone that wants to make a claim, we would gladly reopen it for them. But you can see we asked a bunch of questions to try and ascertain if the consumers had been in any way, shape, or form restituted, because we did not want to give them double recovery. So like I said, there were loan entities that had forgiven consumers' loans, and insurance had paid for many of the consumers. So where we're at today with Woodbury Dental Arts, we've received over 300-plus claims forms as of the beginning of the month. They're undergoing review. We have attorneys looking at them. Again, we're trying to avoid that double recovery because there's a lot of money at issue. We're also working with an expert when necessary to review dental claims because there are a lot of technical issues at here and where they've left consumers. And we can only do restitution. We can't get what's called damages, but we're trying to suss out what that true restitution is. Because of the statute and because we have to pay in chronological order and because the statute mandates that we pay everyone in full, we are handling this one because, like I said at the beginning, it was potentially over $5 million. So we didn't want to move on to the next one before ascertaining that it will be under $5 million. At this point, we think it's most likely under $5 million. We're going to start paying out soon when we have confirmation. When we have enough confirmation of consumers owed to make it financially efficient to issue a number of checks. And again, pursuant to the statute, those folks will be getting full restitution. So we do have some other cases waiting in the wings once we start that. We've got a couple of construction folks. We've got High Road Builders. We've got a $2.6 million judgment against High Road Builders, a fraudulent contractor who told folks he was licensed. He took large down payments. As an aside, this is my bit of consumer protection I love to leave the committee and the audience members with. Don't ever pay for your contractor up front. I know they'll demand it, but make at least do a down payment. Consumer protection moment, back on track to CIPRA. So we had a bunch of consumers that did pay up front because they're trusting Minnesotans and they trust folks they run into. So we've got a $2.6 million judgment, including $1.3 in restitution payments. And that's just a dozen consumers because these were large construction contracts for their homes, their driveways, et cetera. The defendants, from what we can tell right now, we're doing this as we wait for the Woodbury Dental Arts to close. But from what we can tell, they have no collectible assets. And if that's correct, they will be next up for CIPRA. And then you can see we've got another affordable home remodeling, another home contractor, sort of similar thing. We've got more than two dozen victims and $500,000. And we think both these two will be able to be restituted this year. We've also started collecting individual consumer cases, and I just wanted to give you some of these numbers. So these are cases where we don't have a similar defendant, and these are cases where the defendant is unknown. These are the traditional fraud cases that Thomas was talking about. The individuals that get scammed through the grandparent scam, the IRS scam, cryptocurrency, you know all the scams. So far, since collecting them at the beginning of July, we have over 100 individual complaints. Again, unique cases and where the defendants are not readily identifiable. To give you an idea of numbers, we have 9 consumers with claims over $500,000 each. So that's $500,000 each for those 9 folks. Those 9 consumers' claims total more than $5.2 million. So if you do the math, our CIPRA fund is limited to $5 million a year. And we have at least one individual claim whose claim is over $1.5 million. So those folks are waiting in the line, and we are going to see where we're at once we get those three aforementioned cases done and just kind of start working on them. Again, we have to do full restitution, which makes things a little bit tricky when you've got nine folks that total over $5.2 million. Like I said, this is just a preview. You're going to get a fulsome report in October. You can see everything that will be listed there. You'll get to see where the money's coming from, where the money's going, the list of consumer actions, the list of eligible consumers who have been paid and are still and who have not been paid. So hopefully you will get everything you need, and we're always happy to come back and talk for more. I also wanted to highlight sort of two issues you may want to look at with the CIPRA fund and their potential legislative clarifications. One, we talk about the $5 million cap, and that's true for monies that would normally go to the general fund, our penalties, our attorney's fees, all of that. That's capped at $5 million. But as we took a closer look at the statute, we noticed that monies that were restitution that could not be completed, i.e., people didn't make enough claims, people have moved, it's too minuscule to distribute to everyone, that is not capped. And we just wanted to bring that to your attention because we know last session there was a lot of emphasis placed on the cap, and we didn't want to exceed the cap without you knowing that. I don't know that it would be a large amount, that because we try and do fulsome restitution, but that is not subject to the cap. So that is, we place that in your hands if you wanted to correct that. And then finally, it's an issue that came up throughout the presentation, but as you can see, there's going to be insufficient funds to pay all consumers. There was an amendment added at the last minute that talked about capping payments and making and not allowing pro rata payments. As you can see from our numbers, we think there might be a case for pro rata payments, and we would suggest you look at some sort of formula for pro rata payments, especially to get those individual consumers. But even sometimes in these large cases, we think pro rata would be better to allow more recovery for more Minnesotans. I am happy to take any questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. First question is, what does pro rata mean?
So a lesser payment than something full.
Okay.
So we would come up with a formula that said they would get 50% of what they owed in a certain type of fraud. We do this a lot in our own consumer cases because often there's not enough money for full restitution. So we come up with some formula that is fair to try and cover everyone so everyone gets something.
And then can you explain the chronological order? Is it when they submitted the claim, or is it when the court order comes through?
It's the court order. Okay. So it's how we can do the cases and how we get the cases done.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm still frustrated to the AG's office over a statement I made in this committee last year because I have the same group of seniors from a homeowners association that continues to call me twice a month, whatever it is. And what their problem is the lack of communication from your office. And I can get the names again for you, but they don't even know if their case is being processed against their builder. And that's very, very frustrating, not only for them, but for me to say, are they part of this pool? Are they not part of this pool? I think this is a great thing, and I think you guys are doing great work. But we have to also communicate with constituents and to follow up. If you don't have a case, tell them you don't have a case. But please, please be transparent with our constituents. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm hearing about delays in payments. What type of implementation issues or challenges are you having that are contributing to these delays?
So,
Ms. Whitney?
Madam Chair. We have been waiting. Like I said, Woodbury Dental Arts was our first chronological case, so we were waiting to get these claims. So the claims, we gave folks a couple months to get the claims in. We had to get the money in first, right? And the fund is still not filled up to $5 million, but we think we have enough to start. So we got the claims going. Claims took a couple months. Now we're reviewing the claims, and we're just trying to get a big enough number that makes issuing the checks efficient because that it costs money to issue each check, and we're trying to not eat up administration costs. So that's where we're at. And like I said, once we determine that we will definitely be under $5 million for Woodbury Dental Arts, we've got the rest of the cases, and then we're going to start moving on to individual cases teed up is how we're going.
Representative Dodson?
Madam Chair, just a brief follow-up. Can we get more of a timeline of when we can actually expect that to take place?
This is incredibly active right now. This data is changing. I would hope we get checks out within the next month for Woodbury Dental Arts, then moving on to those next two cases. We want to get everything done by June 30th for the fiscal year for this fund.
Thank you.
Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the question, Dotsif. I think he covered most of the questions I was going to ask, so thank you for that. But of the 300 claims, do you foresee what percentage of those are valid of the 300 claims that have been submitted?
Ms. Whitney?
Chair, Madam Chair, Representative, I think we're running pretty good. At this point, I would say at least 75% would be a rough guess. And the other ones are not necessarily not valid. We just need more proof from the consumer that they've paid. OLA audits us, and they audit our money that goes out to consumers, and I'm sure you all want us to be fiscal stewards, good fiscal stewards. So we need proof from them. So a lot of those claims that we haven't been finding true are not necessarily bad. They just need more proof. So we're giving folks a chance to shore up their claim.
Representative Shaw?
Yes, and did this doctor face any kind of criminal charges?
Ms. Whitney?
Madam Chair, the doctor has lost his license and, yes, is not by our office, but by other entities. He is being looked at, yes.
Representative
Shaw? No, state criminal charges, just loss of licenses.
Ms. Whitney?
Madam Chair, let me get back to you on that. I can't remember the status of where he's at, but I can let you know shortly.
Thank you.
That's all.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? I had one. Is there any kind of public-facing website that folks can go to, or is that link buried kind of on the AG's website?
I hope it's not buried. It's our file a complaint, and it's kind of right up there, file a consumer complaint, and then they can click on it, and that's the best place for them to go.
Okay. Is there any outreach being done or PSAs or that kind of stuff for folks?
Madam Chair, we have been talking, we have been issuing press releases, we have been going out in communities, we've been talking at senior centers, we've been talking with AARP, we've been working with Commerce and their senior outreach to try and get the word out. So we are encouraging folks, and we're here today to do even more of that, not only to give you information, but also to hopefully spread the word.
Wonderful, thank you. Any further questions from the committee? I also wanted to mention before we wrap up, we do have pages as well. So Nick Johnson and Ben Lewin are our pages. And so if you guys need anything, please reach out to them. And I was a page back in 2000. Let's not even go there.
A while ago.
And so I got to page Commerce and when Representative Atkins was chair. And so it's kind of fun. So Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to remind members that what does help our staff immensely is when you put your stuff back in, you take your stuff out of your slots and the folders and put all the things that you don't want toward the front of your committee folder. And then, again, there's a save folder that's in there if you want to put anything in there. It certainly does help both CLAs as they're working through their process of getting things going. And with the additional security and things here at the Capitol, that just definitely helps them to do their job. So if we could just show our appreciation, just help get our folders in good order, I think they will appreciate it. And I know that I would appreciate on their behalf that happening as well. So
thank you.
That's all I really have, other than the fact that we're back here tomorrow
morning. Back here tomorrow morning.
We are going to be talking about some artificial intelligence bills. Representative Faulkner has a bill tomorrow as on the agenda. We've got a couple of other smaller bills. No action will be taken on those. They're informational, and we'll talk more about what our goals are for AI tomorrow when we get together. So that's all I have today, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And they have also asked us that we clear this room as quickly as possible so that they are able to get the next committee hearing in here. So with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.